The barking of 1,000 dogs at night, at the limit of earshot. Distant, disembodied sounds. At the edges of the private world, the external signs of other worlds. Night flowing down, a rotating lighthouse. The city seemed through a mist. Distant and peaceful and strange. The sheep coughed. One flower bent slightly towards another. Car wheels rushed ceaselessly in a circle. Leaves sighed overhead. Voices came to her very strangely, floating like flowers on water, cut off from all, like a faint scent. A violin next door, emanating from other worlds. The voices of unseen speakers, the music of unseen musicians. Someone was practicing scales. Some insect dashed at her, boomed in her ear, and was gone. A door opened and shut. Snow flopped from a branch. Otherwise, all was silent. They rose at half-heard melody, the tremor of cut grass, in the evening. One after another the sounds die out, and the harmony falters, and silence falls for the sleepers in the house, as the curtains of dark wrap themselves over the house, so that they lay with several folds of blackness on their eyes. The mantle of silence wave into itself the falling cries of birds, the drone and hum of the fields, the dog's bark, a man's shout, and folded them round the house in silence, the interval of sleep until the chorus beginning. Passed one after another across the sky. Each spread the same ripple, like signals from sunken islands. The being grows rings like a tree, an eye, an ear, a window. A countable series. The little airs that invade the house scarcely disturb the peace. The indifference, the air of pure integrity, in which loveliness and stillness clasp hands. This smoke, this fine early morning air, breath, smoke, clouds. Seen but not touched, amorphous formlessness manifests itself in a random wandering, dancing nuts.
Welcome to the Listening Tide. Our guest today is Valentine Bijfunk. Welcome, Valentine.
Thank you.
To the living room. That's a wonderful build-up, a deliciously thick sort of track to begin with. What did we just hear? What was that?
It is a piece made by the Norwegian sound artist composer Espen Sommereide, and he made the piece for the House of Mares.
Were you a director?
Yes, a center for contemporary culture in Maastricht, and it has a bit of a history because I've been talking to Espen for a long time to do a project for Mares. And we have the habit at Mares to give the house once in a while to an artist to make it their own. So they create one project for the entire house. Mm. And I think I've been talking to Espen for maybe 4 or 5 years until, and we had all kinds of ideas for all kinds of projects. And then suddenly he said, I would like to make an album for
an
the
album.
House. Yes.
There was no talk of anything until that moment.
Everything. We talked about
everything. Okay.
We talked about projects for the blind. We talked about sonification of lots of different subjects. And then suddenly, I think I was visiting him in Bergen at the time, and he said, I think I would like to do an album. And so when Espen says, I want to make an album, it doesn't mean that he's just going to go into a studio and produce. But it meant that he came, I think, for a year and a half, most of the time in between the openings of the exhibition. So he'd come in on Sunday night and leave on Tuesday morning. And he would...
What would be the reason for that?
Sorry, he would be recording sounds. But...
Yeah.
So the premise of the album was for him is that no sound ever gets lost.
Okay.
And the House of Mares exists already since the 1690s.
The building itself.
Yes.
And it's been many different things.
It has a lot of history. It was built for the first mayor of Maastricht, and there have been living several families in it. The last family where the institution is named after was called Mares. Beer brewers, prominent beer brewers in Maastricht. And after that, there was for a short time the Architecture Academy, then like a fledgling art institution before it became Mares. Also, there was for a bit of time an experimental musical or experimental music space. But anyways, so there's a lot of history, and he says, all these walls and all these floors and ceilings still have that sound. We just have to evoke it.
In other words, the building itself, like a sponge, has absorbed time through the sounds that have traveled and been present in the building since its history.
Yes, and he said, we need to let the house speak. And so what he did is, sometimes with these kind of projects, you have I can live very well with the romantic idea of that it exists, but then nevertheless think afterwards or while it's going on, I get a more clearer idea of what actually happens. And in this case, Espen would come to, maybe record, but you could also say make music. So he would come and he would bring a variety of quite outrageous instruments that he all played himself that you wouldn't find in an orchestra or in a band, but just things that produced sound. And then he would let the sound go up against the walls and reverb back, and then he would record it.
These were self-made instruments then, somehow.
Yeah, but then he would say, this is actually a take of a, like, medieval instrument, and he then made it himself, or he found it on some kind of weird market and then changed it a bit. And so, but some would be like string instruments, and I think I've seen him on some form of a bagpipe and all those kind of stuff. Then he had a good friend, Martin Tuxt, who would come on some of the sessions with a micro tuba. You can clearly hear that on this piece.
Yeah.
But he would also, we have a very big garden at Marais, and the garden is a very beautiful green garden. But one of the peculiarities of the garden is that we have a school next door, and the kids always come to fetch their balls. I mean, it must happen six times a day.
Sure.
So at some point he decided, okay, this is now the current history of the house. So he was bouncing the balls in the hallway, mm-hmm. which is a stone hallway of the house, mm. and that makes the rhythm. The rhythm of this
first track we
part
just heard.
Of this track.
Okay.
So you find all kinds of things that are really going on with the house. And then he had a singer you cannot hear on this one, but on some of the other tracks. And he had some kind of sound festival, I think in Edinburgh. He had found Enid Bry, who's like has this BBC voice, mm. and she's like reading from the waves.
It's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And the waves, he used, of course, the Virginia Woolf to make a literary association with the sound that moves through everything and we move through it. And time is like not so fixed.
Yeah.
It could be the past and it could be the present and it could even be the future at the same time.
Does he assign himself a kind of role in this as a, to use a, I don't know if it's the right term, but like as a medium? Or are there any ritualistic aspects to the process, his artistic process, when he came and did this? Other than being a musician and playing at the walls. And opening things up. It could be just that dry and simple, but I'm wondering if there is more to it than that.
Espen is the kind of person that would never openly say that he is interested in mystic things, not that I've known him to say anything to that effect, but he is always working in between worlds, which is to him a reality, mm. without ever going into the spiritual part of it. Mm. It's just that all these layers of reality play a role in his work. And for him, I think they just exist. But I think one of the interesting things he said after he finished the album is that he said, "It's been a long time that I've made music." Because music among sound artists, music is not very popular.
Yeah.
So they'd rather stay away from it because it's too fixed mm. or too constructed or too artificial to them. And he said it was quite liberating to actually start on a venture that really belongs in the history of sonification and sound.
Yeah.
And end up with a true musical album.
He saw this as being a musical album and not the sonification of the space itself, or both?
Because both.
In fact, it is both.
I think both. Hmm. I think both, yeah.
It's interesting. We had a previous guest on The Listening Tide, Nel Donkers, the archivist of the Oppel here in Amsterdam. And she chose to bring an album by an Icelandic artist, Gunnar Gunnarsson, which is called The Janitor's Manifest, and based on his time as being a janitor in the same building that Nel worked, where the archive of the Oppel was. And which was very much a literal translation of his experiences there of cleaning that building. It's not the same as sort of digging out the history, but actually the other way around, in washing the building down and the sonification of that. I think is an interesting sort of maybe role reversal here somehow.
Yeah, I think Espen would be very interested in that that approach, even though he would probably be not so much for the washing. He yeah. would like things to get dirty so you have more material to work with.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you speak to him a lot about this notion of sonification? In preparation for this Listening Tide, you and I spoke about it a little bit and sort of what exactly that is, as it rests on the cusp of illustration, projected
imagination. Yes, I talked to actually Espen and I go back long before he did the album. Well, long, about 5, 6, 7 years, because I asked him to make something for a project, Undertones. And Undertones was a project in Marais where we actually opened up all kinds of subterranean spaces for a sound artist to create pieces for.
Subterranean as in Maastricht and surroundings, in the building?
Yeah, so we have like a great number of caves in Maastricht. We have tunnels of fortifications. We have cellars, basements. There's a lot underneath in Maastricht, more than in other cities in the Netherlands. And so we asked everywhere, looked around everywhere to open up spaces that before and after, I think nobody goes. And there were just the enormous protests on the Taksim Square in Istanbul.
Oh, right.
And he used the sounds of that for the historic prisons that are now just a basement that you can once in a while maybe enter if they open it up for you. But a quite scary environment, like very, very old prisons that are in the center of Maastricht. And while you were walking through the basement, these sounds were... they were quite scary, but only when you let them sort of pervade your skin, that would happen by itself. But you would just walk around and would get under your skin, and you would, at some point, all the visitors would like to get out because it was so intense, even though you didn't particularly hear anybody screaming or you didn't quite know what was going on.
And these were taken and recorded at the Taksim protests and brought to Maastricht.
Yes. And then, of course, he reworked everything he recorded a lot of time. And yet sometimes you can hear it back and sometimes not. But it was definitely an example of sonification where you still can hear something that's going on. But actually the atmosphere is much more important than what the sound itself is. And I think so whether you hear voices or whether you hear protest or whether you can imagine that the sound you're hearing has to do with aggression, for instance. And aggression, of course, we pick up, even though we don't know what's being said, or even, I believe, when you don't hear that people are angry or are shouting. And so I think the beautiful thing of sonification is that it tries to get to an atmosphere even so you don't quite understand what's going on. I also think it's very important of filmmaking to always touch the nerve of something that's going on without you ever knowing precisely what's going on. And but within the realm of sonification, you also have, there was also a piece of an artist, Kathy Matthews, who tried to evoke the sounds that the prehistoric sharks at some point would have made in the quarries,
right?
Because it used to be a prehistoric sea.
Yeah, you Maastricht find a lot of fossils there.
And,
specifically shark teeth.
Yeah. Specifically shark teeth. And there, I mean, sharks make sound, but we can't hear it. So the thing is, the reverberations of their movement in the water, you can sonify and make a piece out of. And I find that always... maybe very abstract. You can have a beautiful piece, of course, and it can be very worthwhile to go after it. But I find it to listen to always harder, even though I understand that the scientific use of sonification, of course, to bring to us the phenomena that we can't hear ourselves.
Is there a scientific part in that that intrigues you, also in and through working with contemporary art on the subject? Because there also is sort of a balance. There is, in the eyes of many academics, but also sonologists and sound artists, who really concentrate on that academic side, And from that comes the sort of the added conceptual layering or imagination, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never really thought very, very hard and long about which part of it really interests me, but it's certainly you have this whole area of infrasound.
Mm-hmm. The low megahertzes.
Yes, we can't hear it, but we know some of the things that are very difficult to conceptualize to ourselves. Like I once spoke to a professor of infrasound from Harvard, and she said one of the things that they found is that when people see ghosts, they in fact don't see anything. They hear something at a certain level of hertz, and that makes them see things.
I believe that's 28, by the way.
I don't know. She was very particular about it, but I forgot the number.
It's just to add to it, I believe it's called the ghost frequency. And the only reason I know this is because of the recent earthquake in New York and the earthquake in, I want to say, Malaysia. I might have to edit that out.
It's been a big one in Japan, you know, about 10 years ago.
Of course. Yeah. So earthquakes make sound that people do not hear, but they feel, they sense. Yeah. And this one, in regards to its megahertz, is very low, which is why we don't hear it but feel it. And it's very close to the ghost frequency, which, as far as I understand, has this low level as well, and creates indeed an aura around your field of vision. And that aura is often mistaken as being an apparition or ghost.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
It's amazing, no? But it's an amazing sort of insight into how our senses work, no? And into how we translate everything to vision.
Yeah.
And maybe we confuse ourselves. But of course, the idea that we use infrasound to make felt or to even measure a lot of things that we cannot hear ourselves, like earthquakes. And to give you an example of a very old-fashioned method, Maastricht used fortifications underneath, so tunnels, to see if they could get under the armies of the opponent, in this case the French. It never worked out, but anyways, they made this whole system. And then you would have all these little tunnels where they would make they put dynamite to then blow up the French army. But it would be very hard to know when the army would be proceeding close enough. So
you above them.
Just, exactly. Yeah. And they didn't listen, but they had little drums with peas on it.
Of course.
And they started to move.
Yeah.
And that is actually the same kind of seismic, I don't know how you call it, measuring as they do now with much better, of course, techniques.
It makes perfect sense that, I was about to mention it as well, it's a military apparatus, as many inventions are initially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or certainly the military is always very interested in these things.
Yeah.
Not a bad movement to our next fragment. That we can listen to. In preparation of this listening tide, we spoke about what different subjects we could speak and sort of converse about. And one of them was the University of Maastricht has been busy with doing research into the Stasi files of former East Germany and the work that they were doing in voice recognition and the interest they had in using voice recognition to basically find out who is speaking with them and which anonymity could be broken. Before we play our interesting invention on how to deal with the subject, could you say a little bit of something why it popped into your head as something that we could discuss here at the Listening Tide?
Yeah, I think the human voice is an unbelievably rich and important subject, I was going to say, but it a lot of human life revolves around communicating with that voice. And the thing is, we are always, in a before life, I used to be an expert in portraiture. And portraiture was,
really?
Yeah, was all about how would you show yourself and how would you be seen and discovered. And a lot of issues of identity come up. And historically, that has changed quite a bit, because in the area where I was studying it, the idea of the likeness was actually a very fluent sort of thought. So people would get actually into fights about what a real likeness was. This is the beginning of portraiture and the proliferation of portraiture. And I think the human voice has for me the same interest, that we always try to listen to the somewhat the core of someone's identity in a voice. And we never only listen to the communication. We always listen to the intention and to what kind of person we have in front of us. Mm-hmm. What do we hear? And when I talked to the director of this Stasi research, Karen Besterfeld, I can of course understand the voice recognition part, but I was specifically interested in the, and they must have been thinking about it, the Stasi, is how can you hear in the voices of the people you listen to their true intentions?
Yeah.
And that is, where is their ideology?
Mm.
What are they going to do? Are they a terrorist to the East German state? Are they wanting to hurt the state system in some kind of way? And that I find very, very... And we have, of course, the polygraph system. Do people lie? Do they not lie?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so far from what we're used to, how people or how the state listens to voices. But I'm convinced we all do it all the time.
Sure.
So we listen to words and we listen to... And we think that is the reason why we listen. But we really listen to voices. And we see what they do and we make up our mind about what people say and do on the basis of their tone, their, you know, whether they have stable voices or unstable voices.
I mean, that's interesting. Also, the polygraph obviously also has a relationship with the pulse of your heart and pressures, and the body plays a role in this.
Yeah,
I'm reminded of the film The Lives of Others, where it really is, and that's what you're speaking about also, only the voice. Often these, what we're talking about in this archive are phone calls and recordings where only the voice is available. There is no body language. There is no further indicators from the body itself. Can ideology be found in the way someone speaks and intonates and their cadence, etc.?
Yeah. And it probably would work like everything works if you just assemble sufficient data, which at the time the Stasi couldn't. So it's like an enormous failed research project, and they had to abandon it anyways, even though the wall fell and that was the end of the Stasi. But the idea is, it's cruel and imaginative at the same time.
Yeah.
But very close to what we all understand, like behind the voice, there's a personality with intentions.
Yeah. Well, for this episode, we did something fun, or at least I thought it was fun. I used ChatGPT for the first time in my life, and you and I decided what better way actually to make explicit this circumstance that we're speaking about by asking ChatGPT specific questions about this subject and letting its voice answer us. So for the audience at home, just that you know, we asked three questions, quite simple ones in a way. The first being, could you tell me if each human voice is unique? The next one, why did the Stasi try to use voice recognition? And finally, can you hear someone's ideological preference in their voice? And we are going to use the voice of ChatGPT to answer this. So I hope you enjoy.
Yes, each human voice is unique. This uniqueness is primarily due to the individual characteristics of the vocal cords, throat, mouth, nasal passages, and other anatomical structures involved in producing sound. Factors such as the size and shape of these structures, as well as their physiological characteristics, contribute to the distinctiveness of a person's voice. Additionally, factors like accent, speech patterns, and vocal habits further differentiate one person's voice from another. This uniqueness is why voice recognition technology is used for security purposes, and why we can often recognize someone simply by hearing their voice. The Stasi, the former East German secret police, attempted to use voice recognition technology as part of their surveillance and intelligence gathering efforts. They were interested in voice recognition for several reasons. The Stasi sought to identify individuals involved in opposition or dissent against the East German government. By analyzing recorded conversations or intercepted communications, they hoped to match voices to known dissidents or suspects. Voice recognition technology could aid in monitoring and tracking the activities of individuals of interest by automating the process of identifying specific voices in intercepted communications. The Stasi could better target their surveillance efforts. The Stasi aimed to gather evidence for use in legal proceedings against perceived enemies of the state. Voice recognition could potentially provide incriminating evidence by linking individuals to subversive activities or illegal actions. However, it's worth noting that while the Stasi may have attempted to use voice recognition technology, the effectiveness of such efforts during that time period would likely have been limited compared to modern capabilities. While certain aspects of speech, such as accent, vocabulary choice, and intonation patterns, may provide clues about a person's cultural background, education, or regional affiliation, it's generally not possible to discern someone's ideological preferences solely from their voice. Ideological preferences are complex and multifaceted, influenced by a variety of factors including personal beliefs, experiences, upbringing, education, and cultural context. While someone's speech patterns and language use may sometimes reflect their ideological leanings to some extent, for example, through the use of specific terminology associated with a particular ideology, it's usually not possible to make definitive conclusions about someone's beliefs based solely on the sound of their voice. Moreover, people can consciously modify their speech or language use to convey certain impressions or to conform to social norms, which further complicates any attempt to infer ideological preferences from voice alone. Therefore, it's generally more reliable to directly engage with individuals and consider their stated beliefs, actions, and affiliations when trying to understand their ideological perspectives.
I'm very happy that ChatGPT understands itself in regards to that last statement.
But it also presupposes that people are upfront and honest about their beliefs and in their statements, no?
As if this GPT is saying, that's your best bet. as a way to find out. And ironic to me, at least, that the one word it seemed to have trouble with in reading this back is the word ideology.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
I think, and also, one of the reasons I was interested personally in doing this in ChatGPT when we were speaking and thinking of a way to raise this subject is obviously what's come from this. Siri and Alexa are realities, which will become even more so realities now and in our future. And that notion of who we are and who we're speaking to and what we get back, there's a lot of resonance in that. To speak in the terms of Espen, I would say also in the sort of the negative idea of what that sponge is.
Yeah. But this is what the big Hollywood strike was about, no? There's going to be a whole world that's going to be replaced by very, very effective machines.
Yeah.
They'll not only have the knowledge, but soon also the visuals to completely replace us, first in entertainment and then probably in a lot of other things.
And if maybe I'm making too big a jump here, but if we bring that back to what you were speaking about in sonification and the notion of imagination, how do those two things relate to each other? So on the one hand, you know, this automatization, this sort of digitalization.
Yeah, I think I never thought very long about it, but I've I assume that that it is like better technique than to give voice, better technique to give voice to all kinds of things that we haven't been able to give voice to in the past.
Mm.
So that's primarily what ChatGPT for us does, or AI does for us now. It brings together a lot of possibilities that we as humans couldn't bring together so easily. Identify an enormous amount of data that we can't identify ourselves, and bring it together and give it identity, mm-hmm. I think, to some extent. And we can, it's a bit of a conceit, of course, because we will feel that that identity might belong to real objects or subjects,
mm-hmm.
but it is, of course, part of a fantasy world. But at some point, it might be difficult to distinguish the reality we feel with our skins and the reality that this fantasy will conjure up for us.
May I ask a personal question?
Of course.
Do you have voices that you miss, that linger in your head, that you somehow wish you could hear, even if you could apply them to other stated subjects or topics, but just the voice itself that would endear you or create a positive sensation, even if that's through pathos or
yeah,
the romantic sense of the word?
I think two things when you say that, maybe not exactly what you're searching for, but the first thing is the voice of my grandmother, who has played an important part in my life. And the second one is the biggest fantasy that I've always have, that when people say, if you could wish anything in your life, what would you choose for? And that is to talk to animals. Oh, yeah. I have always felt like this is the part of life on Earth that I miss most, that would enrich me so unbelievably that if AI were used to give me that possibility, I would be very happy. And then, of course, when the opportunity is there, it turns out to be horrible. but this is the... this is what I would choose it for.
Okay, we're going to head for our last contribution, Valentine. Right. And in a way, there's also a feeling of maybe a part of your own history mm-hmm. in that. It's Miles Davis, together with Jill Evans, Sketches of Spain. We picked the first track to end this episode with, Concerto de Aranjuez, if I'm saying that right, I hope so. Maybe we could speak about the track in a moment and the album. Why this album? Why Miles Davis with Jill Evans?
Yeah, I think for me, it is an album that played a very important part of my life. Like I have throughout my life certain albums and tracks that I play over and over again. So they belong to a certain period in my life. And it was a period in which I was, I think, quite alone. I've always been very, very interested in music, and I have the tendency to, whatever I do, always to study around it, even though there are hobbies and things that I do for which I don't need to study. And I was very intrigued by Miles Davis. I think I got to know him through the album he made with Louis Malle mm-hmm. for the film The Scaffolding. It has a very difficult title. But that movie, which I found very beautiful, and then the difference between that album and, for instance, Kind of Blue and Sketches of Spain, where this is taken from, is that Sketches of Spain tries to bring in all kinds of influences. So it's not only very good music, it is also going in ways that other people haven't gone at that point, and trying something out that is very complicated and might entirely fail. Like, I think for me, Miles Davis, experiment with fusion jazz and funk. And electro-funk, I think, is like terrible. I really dislike it. But yeah. His Sketches of Spain is probably one of the most beautiful albums ever produced for me that I know. And it is, I think, because it's such a beautiful experiment to bring a quite famous guitar concerto, the Aranjuez by Rodrigo, together with Miles Davis, like really his own style and jazz, the free jazz that he was working at the time. And I'm then so intrigued by the decisions of composition the two of them take in the studio to come to this extraordinary piece that is neither this nor that, which I'm always fascinated by, that people can do that.
We're talking 1959 also. What always impressed me about Miles Davis is the duration, the enduring influence that he had on music. Because even that free funk jazz of the 80s and 90s, which, true, you know, there are groups of his fans that love it and others that hate it, it still and always has and always remained influential, the man.
Yeah.
Pretty much until he died.
Yeah.
And there's very few artists in the world that have that. This is 1959. That's my doorbell. Just a nice thing about making these things in a living room. I'm not expecting anything, so I'm not going to open up. I was going to say that maybe interesting to note the backstory to the album itself. As I understood it, is Miles and his wife, Frances Davis at the time, she brought him to a concert. A concert of the flamenco dancer Roberto Iglesias.
Right.
And this is what sort of started it. Like he had heard flamenco for the first time, understood
started
it for
to
the
buy
first time.
Everything in flamenco that he
everything that he could find. Yeah. And then, as you say, started down that journey of creating something that is neither this nor that.
Yeah, it's a very courageous album, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well. Rest for us to play it, Valentine. And before we do, I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Just for you listeners at home, it's raining again, but the sun has shined, and then it went away again, and then it came back again. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.